they can falsely portray me as a traitor, then they can do it to anyone. And in fact, that's exactly the message that they want to get across to you. That if you stand up against Hillary and the party power brokers, if you stand up to the rich and powerful elite and the war machine, they will destroy you and discredit your message.
That was Democratic Congresswoman and 2020 presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard reacting over the weekend to 2016 presidential loser Hillary Clinton, referring to Gabbard in a recent podcast interview as, quote, the favorite of the Russians, and adding that, quote, I think they are grooming her to be the third party candidate. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am Matt Welch, joined by my fellow editorial employees, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and special guest star, Reason Managing Editor Stephanie Slate. Good morning, Russian assets.
Das vidanya, Matt.
Nicely done.
In Soviet Russia, podcast says happy Monday to you.
Almost. Oof. You got the...
Take it back.
You started off strong.
Take it back.
So the Tulsi Hillary wars show no sign of abating so far. All the other Democratic presidential contenders are being asked about it in various fora. Gabbard's first response on Twitter thanked Hillary Clinton, saying, you, the queen of warmongers, should be pronouncing this, you, the queen of warmongers, embodiment of corruption and personification of the rot that has sickened the Democratic Party for so long, have finally come out from behind the curtain, to which Hillary's spokesman, and what a bad job that is, Nick Merrill said, divisive language filled with vitriol and conspiracy theories. Can't imagine a better proof point than this. Merrill also did the hilarious quip of, if the nesting doll fits, I think I already want to drink myself to sleep for the rest of the week. Nick, I want to start with you to give us the broader picture. What, if anything, does this tell us about Hillary Clinton, about foreign policy, the Democratic Party, even the media, which has been piling on Tulsi kind of from the beginning of this whole campaign, doing kind of a heavy breathing about her support among various Russian bots?
It's not worth even, really discussing Hillary Clinton as anything other than a historical artifact at this point. But the point of view she espouses, that anybody who says anything at all, even mildly critical of the military-industrial complex, is immediately a Russian asset, Matt, as you were intimating, is extremely widespread. And it's the generally held background belief of everybody in the media. So, you know, this episode is great because I think it clarifies that and brings it to the forefront. And the idea that people cannot oppose something like continued presence in Syria or a, you know, that we have to get out, of course, but we have to do it in a particular way, blah, blah, blah. Otherwise, you're part of a Russian conspiracy to take over America is a really bad idea, an idea fix that we really need to shake once and for all. It's so pernicious. And ironically, of course, it plays into Russian disinformation efforts. So, good on Tulsi Gabbard for really calling bullshit on this. And a couple of the other Democratic candidates, Pete Buttigieg, I believe Bernie Sanders, have also said, you know, Hillary, just shut up at this point because you're wrong and you're embarrassing everybody.
Suderman, you are our resident Manorms person here, even more than me, perhaps. Can you reflect? Can you tap dance? Can you Gandhi dance for a moment on the norm violations of Hillary repeatedly not accepting an electoral defeat and also, I don't know, doing a little McCarthyism here?
I wish I had Norm Macdonald here to talk about how he was being violated by this. But since I don't...
Tell you what, Peter!
I'm feeling great this morning, guys. Hillary Clinton should not be talking to the media.
Wow,
that is my opinion.
Much?
She should just stay out of this. She's not doing herself any favors. She's not doing her legacy any favors. She is adding nothing of value to this debate at this point. And I think it's a mistake for people who sort of have the option to either cover her or not to be doing so. I frankly think, like Nick said, she is such a non-presence at this point in American politics that it's a mistake to be going and asking the candidates about her, to be talking about this at all, because she's over. There's just Hillary Clinton is just not a factor in American politics anymore. She had her chance. She had her chances and she lost all of them. And so it's a multiple layer mistake here. And that's why Norm MacDonald is so upset.
Slade, since you're subbing in for Catherine Mangu Ward here, who is in an undisclosed bunker somewhere, I enjoy asking Catherine really, really long questions that are impossible to follow. So I'll start with you here. So part of Hillary's accusation that Tulsi's being groomed by the Ruskies to be a Green Party candidate, even though Tulsi Gabbard told CNN as recently as last month, no, I'm totally ruling out a third party run. Clinton also said this, that's assuming Jill Stein will give it up, which she might not because she's also a Russian asset. Yes, she's a Russian asset. I mean, totally. They know they can't win without a third party candidate, unquote. As the person who I always ask about polling numbers and other things, can you explain in English language how or even if Hillary's kind of a bedrock assumption here that Jill Stein acting as a Russian asset or not cost her the election is not necessarily accurate?
Yeah, I'll try. The sort of claim that's being made here that has, I suppose, some surface plausibility is that people who voted for Jill Stein in 2016, probably their second choice would have been Hillary Clinton. And so if Jill Stein hadn't been in the race, they would have voted for Hillary. And so by her staying in the race, she was able to swing the election away from Hillary and to Donald Trump. And the evidence for this is that in those handful of states where the Trump's margin of victory was very small, in some cases, Stein won 10,000 votes where Trump won by 7,000 votes. Now, of course, if you actually take any time at all to think this through, you realize that this assumes a lot of things, including that 100% of the people that voted for Jill Stein, if she hadn't been on the ballot in that state, would have shown up on election day rather than staying home, and that 100% of them would have voted for Hillary Clinton. And again, you can understand why somebody might go, well, she's the far left candidate. Hillary is the next leftmost candidate. Probably they would have defaulted to Hillary Clinton if they weren't voting for Jill Stein. But think about what it takes to go to the polls in 2016 when the opponent is Donald Trump and to vote for Jill Stein. You got to have a real big problem with Hillary Clinton to do that. So the idea that all of these people who voted Jill Stein, who voted third party, would have bothered to show up on election day and would have cast their ballots for Hillary Clinton is just, there's just no evidence to support that. It really makes almost no sense at all to believe that that's true. And that's the only way that it makes sense that Stein could have thrown this election. And of course, the other big sort of assumption here is that the Russians had anything to do with her candidacy in the first place. All of that I just said would all still be true, and we could have that conversation even if she just was a random third party candidate. I mean, a lot of times you'll hear libertarians talk about whether it's reasonable to think that the LP candidate might swing an election, from the Republican to the Democrat, and we can have that conversation. And you don't need an outside third party government in order, an outside government involved in this for this to still be a conversation that we can have. And so there's literally no evidence that anybody has been able to raise of Russia's involvement with any of these people. And so this comes back to the idea of norms. It ought to be considered deeply irresponsible for somebody like Hillary Clinton to be making statements and making accusations against other candidates from her, within her own party, even in this most recent case, without any evidence at all of Russian interference.
So I want to, can I add just a little bit in there? I have a weird small burning ember of empathy for Hillary Clinton here. She was a terrible candidate. She would have been a terrible president. She shouldn't be involving herself in this way. On the other hand, Russian intelligence hacked John Podesta's email, her campaign chairman. Russian intelligence hacked the DNC and released that information strategically to try to hurt Hillary Clinton.
What does that have to do with Jill Stein?
It has nothing to do with Jill Stein. Nothing at all to do with Jill Stein, as far as I can tell. Nothing to do with Tulsi Gabbard, as far as I can tell. And so she is making leaps of logic here that aren't logical, that aren't warranted at all. At the same time, her campaign was targeted by Russian intelligence. There's no question that happened, and that they released information that was designed to hurt, that was intended to hurt her campaign.
And what are the roots of that? Why did Putin have it in for Hillary Clinton, et cetera? We can tumble down this hole, but it's because Hillary Clinton went out of her way to try and make sure that Putin was not elected, to interfere with the Russian election using American statecraft as well as subterfuge. I think the real focus here can't be on Hillary Clinton, who is just sad at this point. It needs to be on this continued fixation that Americans have with, you know, the idea that there is a shadowy cabal of Russians who are dictating the outcomes of election or other aspects of our lives. And it particularly comes up in foreign policy, because it's not an accident that this is all built around the fact that Tulsi Gabbard is an anti-war candidate, and specifically it has been extremely critical of our intervention in Syria, where Russia is a factor. But, you know, we need to, like, fully confront the idea that Russia, you know, 30 years after the Cold War ends, continues to be the bugaboo in American foreign policy and American discussion of domestic policy. I mean, it's like, for God's sake, we really need to, you know, get into the 21st century.
One thing about the smear on Jill Stein, and it is a smear, even though she did show up at that weird dinner in Moscow or wherever in Russia.
Yeah, with the future Trump advisor.
With Mike Flynn. And also, I think, was it Rocky Anderson? Some like a 12th tier presidential candidate was also there. But the problem with a lot of these articles about Tulsi Gabbard and, you know, how she has a fan base among Russian bots and also Jill Stein, they made similar things, is that there's almost never any attempt to say, hey, look, they changed their foreign policy here. Jill Stein ran for president in 2012, back when Hillary Clinton was resetting the relationship with Russia because there was a perceived opening with Dmitry Medvedev. So was she a Russian asset then? Did she and or the Green Party change the way that they have been consistently anti-imperialist, you know, or U.S. imperialism since the get-go? I mean, there's no space in between what she was talking about in terms of foreign policy, in terms of Russia, in terms of U.S. military intervention, and what Ralph Nader has been saying forever. So, like, how does that work? And Tulsi Gabbard is the same way. I haven't seen much evidence that on a specific issue that you could point to, she departed from where she was originally in a weirdly pro-Russian direction. It's just that she's not interventionist very much. But Peter, as the resident, there should be a think tank about foreign policy that's less interventionist among us. Tulsi is a little bit weird, right? Like, she's weird. Just as you got the white streak in her hair, that's weird. She says aloha every third sentence. She plays footsies with Hindu nationalists. She went to Syria weirdly to meet with Assad. Is she not weird?
I mean, you seem to think she's weird. The white streak that seems pretty lookist to me. And also, yeah, like, I mean, that it's Rogue in the X-Men has the same thing, and it's awesome. And it's also awesome when Tulsi wears it. So I just don't think the white streak is all that weird. And saying aloha, she's from Hawaii, dude. That's...
I suppose so. I still haven't gotten over. I want Hawaiian independence. I'm the only person who really believes in true Hawaiian.
What do you have against pineapple, Matt?
You know, I just want it to be self-sustaining, localized pineapple, Nick. I don't think that we should be eating imperialist pineapples here among us. All right, Sudhir, you didn't take the bait, so let me go back to Slade here. I want to ask you a question
That's what this podcast is really about, isn't it?
What?
Take the bait.
Trying to get people to take the bait.
Yes.
Mostly me.
Yes. Come on. Slade, I want to ask you a question. I asked Steve Kornacki of MSNBC on a...
Worst name drop ever.
What do you mean? He's a very good poll number guy. Cruncher.
Yeah, okay. So now we're talking... I would rather talk about the Russians than Steve Kornacki on the recent podcast.
He's no Stephanie Slade when it comes to crosstabs.
Yeah. At any rate, Tulsi Gabbard, who we're talking about here, has been polling at around 1%. Like the entire campaign in national polls, I think the last Real Clear Politics average has her in 11th place. Which, why are you laughing?
Yeah, well, because polls don't mean anything at this point in the election, Matt. So,
well, that's the question.
So, I think Tulsi is probably the favorite, really, when you think about it.
I love this. I don't even have to be here. Yeah. Nick's doing it for me this time.
This is undermining of the questioner here. No, in the history of my lifetime, it's getting less recent by the minute, the longer I'm on the phone with Nick here. But Yeah, Jimmy Carter in 1975 at around this time was kind of nowhere in what polls there were. George McGovern in 1971, arguably Bill Clinton in 1991. So there is precedent for people kind of being long shots at this stage of the campaign. But like campaigns start earlier now, are polled way much more now. Is it useful to look at the history of kind of long shot bids and say, ah, you know what, Tulsi doesn't really have a chance? Or once again, is it too early to be looking at polls? What say you, Stephanie Slade?
It is. I mean, it is too early to be drawing any kind of major conclusions about what's going to happen from polls. But I mean, OK, I will moderate that and say people are already dropping out. Right. And they're dropping out because they're not getting any traction. We had a field of 20. We're down to 14 or something. And the reason that people drop out is because they cannot seem to break above. They're just it's clear to them that they're not going to break apart from the pack. So in that sense, the polls mean something. They mean something in terms of as candidates are making strategic choices about whether or not to go forward and about how to go forward. They're looking at their poll numbers. And so a candidate who can't seem to get out of the, you know, get above 1% or get out of the single digits even is probably not going to make it all the way till next summer when the final you know, voting is happening and the nominee is nominated. So it's not that they mean nothing, but it seems very unlikely to me. Yeah, it seems unlikely to me that somebody who's at 1% at this point in the race has much of a chance at all to make it all the way until next summer. I guess that is as far as I will go in terms of how useful are the polls or what conclusions can we draw from, you know, what's being told to pollsters today in October. That's different from saying that we can look at the polls and make predictions about who the actual nominee will be, because so many people have not even tuned in at all. I mean, literally, there was in 2012 and 2016, there's this amazing graphic you can look at where the Google search terms for like, you know, Republican primary, people start Googling it in like January. Like they start doing their research. There was zero people searching that term. And then in January, people are like, huh, I think there's an election this year. Maybe I should like look into this a little bit. So in October, all those people haven't even started paying attention at all.
Matt, you have a history with John McCain.
Yes.
You smoked him out with gusto, if I'm recalling correctly.
And thank you.
Where was he at this point in the, you know, 1898 election or whatever he ran and you became
around the, fourth or fifth place at around 10%. He almost there was at this point in 2007, the journalist Ryan Sager, I believe, if I'm not mistaken this, and if I am, I'm sorry, I'm getting the wrong person, maybe confusing him with Craig Sager, had a McCain death watch, not meaning actual death, but death of his campaign in 2007, because a lot of people thought that he fired 2/3 of his staff in July of that year. But he put all of his chips down on New Hampshire and just spent the rest of the campaign doing town halls in New Hampshire, having frank talks about the necessity of a surge in Iraq and saying, you know, bomb Iran and stuff.
October 21st, 2007, first place, Giuliani, second place, Fred Thompson.
Right.
So that's how far out we are.
That race was incredibly fluid. Mm. The 08, 012, the 2012 races
012.
Were just like... The 2012, 2008 races were like, it was like every 3 weeks there was a new front runner. And they were just sort of fascinating to watch. I think with Tulsi, the polling is in some ways a little bit beside the point with her candidacy. Her candidacy is not designed to win. What it is designed to do is draw attention to the merits and the arguments for a less aggressive, less interventionist foreign policy within the Democratic Party, which is nominally the less interventionist party. Now, in practice, that's often not the case. But in theory, it's the Republicans who are sort of the bastion of a, you know, pro-military hawkishness and Democrats who aren't. And the point of Tulsi Gabbard and the point of her presidential run isn't 1% or 2% or 6%. The point is someone is going to stand on that stage and say, let's bring troops home. We're fighting a bunch of wars that are stupid and that we shouldn't be fighting. I know because I was there.
Nick, and this could be a way to maybe transition to talking a little bit about the debate last week, the fourth debate here. A thing that I find curious about what Peter just said, which is not wrong, surprisingly, I'm just kidding, is that it's always Tulsi who gets that love, the anti-war love. Yet on the debate stage, you find quite a few, not in this case Pete Buttigieg, in a very interesting exchange the two of them had on this difference of opinion. But Elizabeth Warren, as Peter has pointed out before, is like, let's bring the troops home from Afghanistan. You have Bernie Sanders, Beto O'Rourke. A lot of people are making noises about things like congressional approval is required. We should draw down. We've been doing disastrous regime change wars and et cetera. And yet she gets all the attention. Do you have any theories?
Well, it's partly because this is the defining attribute of her contribution to the political debate, Matt. So she's kind of like Peter Criss in Kiss. You know, he's known for singing Beth, a power ballad. He's even more than being the drummer, because that was his unique contribution to the one of the greatest rock and roll quartets of all time. And so it is with Tulsi Gabbard talking about foreign policy and really bringing that to bear in a discussion of people. You know, nobody is going to pretend that Elizabeth Warren is leading with foreign policy or Bernie Sanders, et cetera.
Right.
So I think that helps explain it.
That's very clarifying. Tulsi Gabbard is the Peter Criss of the Democratic
She's
Party.
She's the space cat, you know?
The Democratic Party is no Kiss, and I think that's where we have the problem here. But let's talk about the debate last week.
I'll tell you right now, if they put on Kiss makeup, I would vote Democrat. Like just one of them.
Do you think Beto has put on the Kiss amazing? Yeah, no, or is it just furry only?
It's his version of blackface. There's probably pictures of him dressed, I'm betting he would be like Paul Stanley. He would be a star child.
How you doing today?
I think it's cold gin time again.
If there's one thing that I can beseech all listeners to consume culturally, maybe I'm just preempting my own thing later on, is go and seek out Paul Stanley. There's a term of art for rock and roll singers saying, "How you doing tonight, Detroit?" And just it's a super mix cut of all of those, and it'll restore your faith in what's left of American democracy. All right, we had a debate last week. Democrats, 12 of them, including Tulsi Gabbard, including Beto O'Rourke and Gene Simmons. They were all there on stage looking for one big takeaway from each of the three of you. You start first, Peter Suderman.
Elizabeth Warren got tripped up yet again with her healthcare response. She spent about a half an hour on this debate just having everybody pile onto her and say, look, you're just very obviously not saying the thing that is obviously true, which is that taxes will go up under a Bernie Sanders style single payer Medicare for all plan. Bernie Sanders says that. He wrote the damn bill, as he likes to remind people. And so you had this actually kind of fascinating exchange in which Pete Buttigieg, Klobuchar, and even to some extent, Bernie Sanders were just like, yeah, Elizabeth Warren, you should say that. And she keeps just refusing to say this. The moderators are pushing her on it, saying, well, don't you, if you're for Bernie's plan, aren't you for the taxes that are part of Bernie's plan? And to be clear, Bernie Sanders has not outlined a plan to fully finance Medicare for all, as he would have it, but he has said that taxes would go up. So it's just a really interesting dynamic where she just totally refused to break from her talking points, totally refused to say it. And everybody else on stage kind of lambasted her for not saying that taxes will go up, as in every other country that has a single payer or fully government run healthcare system. It's largely financed. It is heavily financed with taxes on the middle class. And Elizabeth Warren was just like, nope, that's not going to happen. Costs will go down for everyone except rich people and corporations. And so she has now been put in a position where she's saying, well, I'm going to have a plan and it's going to come out and I'm working on it, because it is kind of notable that for someone who has run on a I have a plan for everything campaign, she didn't put out a healthcare plan. All she did was say, I'm with Bernie. And she has offered this sort of this very shallow, no detail endorsement of the Bernie Sanders Medicare for All plan, and then kind of refused to go along with one of the things that even Bernie Sanders says, which is taxes will go up.
One of the interesting kind of minor journalistic subplots After the debate was there's a talk among journalism professor Jay Rosen and a few other people like absolutely lambasting CNN for continuing to demand that Elizabeth Warren say what it's going to cost.
Why?
It's journalistic malpractice.
Did they explain why?
To keep asking for a realistic price tag of a government program.
So I can explain their argument, and it's a bad argument, but I can explain it. And what their argument is that it is in fact misleading people to say to focus only on taxes, because under Medicare for All, this argument goes, under Medicare for All, most people will actually see their total costs go down. So instead of paying through premiums and all of that, maybe your taxes would go up a little, but the total outlay from your personal budget would be less. You would have more money overall, and more people would be covered. So that is their argument, and therefore, what they want to see is a focus on total costs. And so they say, well, asking about taxes just sort of misses the total costs equation, part of the equation, and that's what Elizabeth Warren is focusing on, total costs, because that's what Americans care about. Here's the problem. Single payer, as envisioned by Bernie Sanders and endorsed by Elizabeth Warren, that Medicare for All plan, there's good reason to believe that total costs would actually go up for many, if not most people. Ken Thorpe, a liberal healthcare economist who has actually endorsed and put forth single payer plans in the 2000s, has done an analysis of one of the iterations of Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan, and found that something like 71% of people would see their costs, actually their total costs, go up. And so I think even this argument is fundamentally wrong, because it misunderstands how Medicare for All would probably work, and just some of this kind of core economic debates about how the financing mechanisms would work and what would happen under it.
Slade, what was one takeaway that you had from the debates?
Mine was pretty similar to Peter's, actually, but I wanted to sort of focus in on this Yang's stupid math pin, his math lapel pin, because I think that is really illustrative.
Oh, come on, it's cute.
It would be cute if it were being worn by somebody who was actually doing math. Ooh. But that's my problem. Like, his plan, he's a single issue candidate. He's
Savage.
Running entirely on the need for us to implement $1,000 a month universal basic income for every American over the age of 18. And his own numbers don't add up. His own campaign can't figure out how to pay for it. And yet he has the gall to walk out onto that stage wearing a math lapel pin. And that, to me, just is representative of everything that's wrong with our politics in general, and especially Democratic politics. This sort of idea that, like, magical thinking and fuzzy numbers are what they're trading in. And yet they have the, like, they have no shame. They're willing to also hold themselves out and describe themselves as, like, the realists when it comes to, like, policy wonkery, and the ones who are really engaging with facts. And of course, because of who they're looking across the aisle and seeing, they can kind of get away with it, but we shouldn't allow them to get away with it. It's absurd and insulting.
We are in the season of magical thinking when it comes to budgetary math, for sure, and I think have been for about the last 4 years, arguably longer, depending on how cynical Nick wants to be about this. Nick, what was a takeaway from the eyes of Nick Gillespie from this debate?
Oh, now I'm already thinking of the eyes of Laura Mars, which would be much more interesting to talk about Matt Welch or Gary Gilmore's eyes. Yeah, no, to talk about anything other than the last CNN. And debate. We kind of skipped over the LGBTQ town hall, which I think is also worth discussing, because on a certain level, it was a terrible shit show for the candidates, but it was actually a better media event, I think, because candidates were actually forced to have detailed conversations and kind of follow-ups on things. And that, to me, the big takeaway is the Democratic candidates as a group are terrible. And they make it very likely that Donald Trump will absolutely win re-election if he can keep his big mouth shut, which, is one of the biggest ifs since Rudyard Kipling, took the dirt nap. Having said all of that, the real shame should be on the media, which in general has conducted terrible debates that are not elucidating for all sorts of reasons. And, shame on you people in the media, except for me and my recent colleagues, because you're just not structuring conversations that are on the most basic level interesting and engaging, but then more importantly, that actually illuminate anything about politics. I mean, this—it's just—it's awful. It's just really awful.
I made the mistake of being overgenerous during the last debate because Anderson Cooper started it off, and I think even his first question, or the first one that I was able to register in between my no good children distracting me, was good. And I recalled from a previous exercise looking at his first debate. It was the first debate of the season in 2015. And he was phenomenal. It was almost like a one man hacksaw, or those little pointers that you do with D'Artagnan and stuff. Thank you for helping.
Jesus Christ.
But like, no, he was great. He was really well prepared in that debate. And so I'm like, hey, it's great. Anderson Cooper's going to be here. And but then I think you're right, Nick. The overall discussion was not the best in the world. My takeaway was not that, because I am not an anti-media populist, which we'll get into in a second here. But mine was Mayor Pete Buttigieg's I seemed to perceive, perhaps alone, as trying to create a new lane in this, a new kind of ideological lane in this overall race, which is to say, he, like Joe Biden or like an Amy Klobuchar, was happy to turn his guns on unrealistic, unmathed kind of economic proposals, whether it's the Medicare for All by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, or on Beto O'Rourke's just like, let's take all the guns, let's be an advertisement for the NRA type of things. And he's like, why would you do that when you could actually do other smaller, more achievable gun control? So in one sense, he was being Johnny Sensible centrist, but then he also pivoted, interestingly, to my thought, against the notion of Joe Biden's candidacy being like some kind of restoration, like it's a reset back to normal. And he's like, normal wasn't good enough, bro. And I think he's right about that in a way that is interesting. We'll see where he goes with that. I don't have any hope for anything, generally speaking, but like he is right. And one of the things that has irritated me about the people who are anti-Trump in ways that I otherwise kind of tend to agree with more often than not, whether they're Democrat or kind of the never Trump Republican rump, is that there isn't a whole lot of, hey, look, we got stuff wrong, us establishmentarianisms. That's not a word. We messed up and we need to rethink how we contributed to this. Pete Buttigieg, whether it's out of, cynical self-interest, it probably is. He's a politician, but he seems to be saying that. And I think that is a right and accurate thing to say, in addition to being possibly something that can grow his share. There's new polls saying that he's doing slightly better in Iowa, but I think people are leaping on that because they want a new media narrative as much as anything else. But anyways, that was my big...
Wait, I thought you weren't against the media. I thought this whole thing was out. No, the media's fine.
It's just
Buttigieg is just a narrative.
I'm not an anti-media populist, Suderman. Just you gotta.
Are you a pro-media populist?
I'm not a populist, Nick. I'm like Andy Kaufman. I'm from Hollywood. Okay.
Yeah,
we're smart.
Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough.
So one of the dumber exchanges, Nick, I want to get you in on this, came from the when Kamala Harris was like trying to stop everything. And ask Elizabeth Warren, oh, look, you're not even going to like kick Donald Trump off Twitter. What are you even doing? What's wrong with you? It wasted a lot of time. But then Elizabeth Warren, because she has to regulate every aspect of human activity, then after the debate came out with some big plans to regulate political speech on Facebook and all this kind of crap. Meanwhile, Donald Trump or lawyers associated with Donald Trump threatened to sue CNN, get substantial damages for their false advertising of calling themselves a news organization and defaming and blah, blah, blah. It's yet another Trump threat. We seem to be in a moment of anti-media populism, Nick, that is translating into some pretty bad policy ideas, particularly about social media. Is there any reason to do anything but despair, Nick?
Well, I mean, we got to push back. And I agree with you completely, Matt. When you think about one of the most dispiriting aspects of the last debate was the Democratic field, let's say, are people like Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren has said we need to regulate political advertising. We need to regulate political speech, more and more than we do. And that Facebook is failing to do that. She's already talked about breaking up Facebook. She is a free speech, villain here. Kamala Harris, like saying Trump should be kicked off of Twitter. What the fuck? I mean, really? And then Trump... himself is awful on this front. What's good is that when Trump says something like that, it actually creates a robust counter reaction, which is good. But what scares me is that when Democrats do it, people are like, oh, yeah, that's really thoughtful. That's really thoughtful. We're in a paroxysm of anti-free speech, anti-free expression, and it goes much wider and broader and deeper and further than politics. You know, I just posted something at Reason.com this morning about Nick Cave, the great singer-songwriter, even despite being Australian, author, et cetera, you know, has written about why he finds woke culture kind of stultifying and repressive and repellent in his term. You know, we're in a broad-based reaction, a counter-reaction against free speech. We are forgetting that, you know, free speech as we know it is only about 50 or 60 years old. We shouldn't be giving it up this quickly, but, you know, because of feelings, because, you know, we might misgender somebody, we might say things that are offensive to people. You hear a lot of people, especially younger people, but increasingly older people say, you know, we need to balance free speech with this, that, and the other thing. And it's like, no, that's fundamentally wrong. You're seeing it show up in politics, and that's where we really need to be scared of it. And in tech policy, I mean, this is all undergirding the attacks on things like Section 230 and the, you know, the basic architecture of internet free speech and internet free expression. We got to do more than despair, Matt. We got to talk up the benefits, not just simply of free speech in and of itself, but of a culture of free speech where people don't need to be dicks about stuff, but we need to have a culture where people are free to say what they think. Without that, you know, we might as well be Russia.
Slade, talk a little bit about the kind of centrality of the anti-speech, particularly the kind of on the social media thing that is coming out of your pals in the illiberal conservative movement. We've had this long manifesto season of various First Things authors and everywhere else, and it's just jarring to me how much that seems to be like central to the argument. We got to go after pornography, and this time we mean it, man. And also, like, the biggest, one of the biggest problems in America are all these giant social media companies with their boots on their neck. What have you perceived over there in that world?
That is cause for despair for me, is that the sort of fusionist right of center coalition that was basically in favor of markets and individual liberty, and conservative traditional social values, but not at the point of a gun, that this has been the consensus for decades on the right, and it has completely collapsed this year. And so there is a quite influential movement to say we need to get the government involved in reorienting society back to the sort of Judeo-Christian values that were so important, you know, to the culture of America, were supposed to be so important. Forgotten is the very important cultural values of America, of like freedom and free expression and whatnot. But it is a little bit incoherent, because these folks on the right, they're saying a few different things that are hard to reconcile. So, for example, they're saying we must crack down on pornography. Free speech is worth trading away in order to protect our children, basically. But then they're also saying we need to break up big social media companies because they're not giving because Facebook and Twitter are infringing on the rights of conservatives to voice their perspective, or Google is infringing on the rights of James Damore to have an unpopular opinion about gender. So they both want government to step in to infringe people's rights to free expression to advance their goals, their sort of values when it comes to, again, the sort of restoring the Judeo-Christian heritage and the moral cult, you know, texture of the United States culture. And they want government to step in to stop big left of center institutions, cultural institutions, from being unfair to their perspective and from infringing on their right to speak and to have opinions. So it's totally incoherent. It basically amounts to might makes right, and we should seize the power in order to get our way. And it's very disturbing to me.
Suderman, is there anybody in the Democratic field, or is there anybody even just in the anti closets of Congress who are leading anything like a counterattack, or just kind of saying, whoa, slow down, let's not regulate all the things?
Ron Wyden, a Democratic senator who helped put together Section 230, it has been consistently good on the issue in terms of explaining what its value is and why it was put in there to begin with and why it's still necessary and relevant today. And in making the case that Section 230, what it actually does is it enables private companies to do some amount of content moderation without fear of being said, you know, of people saying, well, you're discriminating, you're sort of, this is a problem. And you know, kind of making the argument that without Section 230, what you would have is a more restrictive regime in which the people who want to get rid of or modify Section 230 would actually have less access to speech and to platforms and would find even less purchase online. And so Ron Wyden, I think, you know, has often been one of the Democrats in the Senate who has been, let's say, somewhat more friendly to libertarian ideas and ideals, that continues to be the case with, at least with regards to Section 230.
Yeah, he's terrible on campaign finance law, though, and this, but I agree with you, Peter. You know, Wyden is, broadly speaking, a civil libertarian who's almost unmatched on either the Republican or Democratic sides, but you know, this gets to the larger point, Matt. I know you used to write a lot about this, of, you know, the idea of either government at the federal level or the state or local level licensing or defining who counts as a journalist, what sorts of speech are considered, you know, explicitly political in terms of campaigns and hence, you know, should be regulated versus other, et cetera. And, you know, we really, really need to be pushing hard about, you know, we're in a moment culturally and technologically where we can finally say what we think, how awful all of that may be. And we're blowing it. We're ruining it. The minute that we have terrible, terrible freedom, it's like we're going back down underground. We're afraid of our own shadows. And we really need to make a robust argument for a culture of free speech in all sorts of ways, however uncomfortable that makes us, however much dark money and dark speech that brings to bear. I mean, without that, you know, we're nothing.
Hashtag dark.
I mean, online speech just feels different in kind and in quality to a lot of people. And I think it's incumbent upon us to make the argument that it's not, it's sort of more intense in certain ways, that it's more accessible and available at the same time. But there is this feeling, I think, amongst a lot of people, amongst young people as well as parents, just that it is inescapable and unavoidable. And that therefore, because you kind of can't get away from Facebook, because you can't get away from online pornography, because you can't get away from all of these kinds of, you know, sort of, because online speech is so pervasive and so accessible to so many people, that there has to be some sort of control. And I think that's a very bad way of thinking about it. At the same time, we need to sort of talk people through this feeling that it is different, that something has changed, that is not just sort of it's not just sort of that it's more speech and that's good, but that this is different speech and that online speech is harmful. And we need to sort of be cognizant of that as we argue through this, because there really are a lot of people who feel assaulted and threatened by various forms of online speech and the way that it is both moderated and also doled out.
To be clear, all of that is different from the thing that Trump is doing, which is like claiming that he has that he can sue CNN because they're claiming to be a news organization, but they're not giving him the coverage he thinks he deserves.
That's like, correct.
That is an entirely different thing that doesn't even really deserve to be taken seriously at all and should in fact be mocked mercilessly by all of us. The other stuff is
on Twitter.
On Twitter. This other stuff, which is more, which is coming from both left and right, but not quite as much from Donald Trump himself, is more about the need to treat these big social media platforms as public utilities and regulate them. And that's the argument that's being made there, which is also really deeply troubling. But I think it's more dangerous because the other stuff, the Donald Trump lawsuit it's not going to get anywhere, right? Like nobody thinks that's serious. It would never succeed in court. This other stuff, the public utility regulation, like they have a precedent that they can follow to try to make that actually happen. I would like to believe that they won't succeed, that the courts would come down on the side of the First Amendment. But, you know, they're at least going to make a serious sort of push here.
Yeah, and I mean, Trump is certainly part of this, and we just sort of have to recognize that the fact that Trump has decided that Twitter is his platform and that's how he's going to talk to the world and that he is going to communicate through Twitter primarily has changed how people view online political speech and has soured a lot of people on it in ways that I think are having kind of destructive ramifications I would certainly like to see a presidential candidate run on, I promise not to tweet.
How about TikTok, Peter?
Yeah. No, you know what, though? And when you think about people, politicians like AOC and whatnot, and Trump, this is it gives them an ability to really directly communicate with the public in a way
that
is absolutely liberating and, somewhat terrifying at various points. But, I'm in favor. I don't want a president who doesn't tweet. I think Trump's biggest problem isn't that he's tweeting. It's that he's not fully immersed in a kind of new media landscape. By all accounts, he doesn't actually read email. He doesn't type, things like this. I want a president who is of the moment and who understands what is going on and what is new and different and gets to a point where, the great thing about internet culture, and I think internet culture is an epiphenomenon of this larger cultural change that happened after World War II and partly in response to what we saw as the repression of the Soviet Union of free thought and free expression, free minds, as well as free markets. We live in an incredibly participatory culture. And right now, Peter, you're absolutely right. People are freaking out and, about there's too much participation. It's ubiquitous. We can't get away from it. I think younger people don't understand why we fought for free speech. And I think older people, particularly parents, are terrified that, things are different now. And this isn't, Bob Dylan singing protest songs or the Sex Pistols ranting about the Queen. This is serious, man. And we have to constantly be reminding people of where we came from so that we can really fully appreciate all of the opportunities in front of us. And, we'll get to it, Matt, when we talk about what we're consuming. It's not a coincidence that we have this flowering of culture of art, music, video, literature, and other forms of creative expression, and a technology and an innovation and the death of gatekeeper institutions that allow us to you can't have more speech and they'd be like, oh, but we're going to regulate it, or it's only going to be good speech, it's not going to be the shit I don't like. It's all or nothing.
The problem is not Twitter. The problem is not that the president tweets. The problem is what the president tweets and the fact that he gets most of his information, it seems, from Fox and Friends.
I would just add to Peter's observation about people feeling like you can't escape Facebook and Twitter, and yet growth for both are flat. People are not adopting. The kids are on TikTok. As the father of an 11-year-old girl, which is the target audience of people to panic about, or at least I'm the target audience for panicking, you can do this thing, which is like, nope, you don't get an Instagram account. Until I say you can get one later on. And that goes a long way. Of course, you cannot escape porn. Let's be clear about that. No one has ever been able to escape porn. We couldn't even escape to porn in the 70s back then. But okay, there's that. But you can actually control or have some say in your own kids' adoption or lack thereof of social media. And I recommend it. I recommend like talking it through. All right, let's go to what you are consuming. I'm going to go first because I want Nick to laugh at me. But speaking of aforementioned 11-year-old, I live in a household surrounded by people with even worse taste in movies than I do. And we try to have like a family movie night. And the original concept was like, okay, let's use this as a vehicle to expose the terrible children to classics like, E.T. and things like that, right? Immediately hijacked by the now 11-year-old to try to get in, stupid Peter Sudeikis Marvel movies and whatnot. And so it arises now, always ends up in an awful compromise of movies that are misleadingly sold to me as classics. And last night we saw one of them, the 1998 Dennis Quaid, Natasha Richardson, Lindsay Lohan vehicle, The Parent Trap. People, I'm here to tell you, and I say this with great and grave sadness and regret, that maybe the 1990s weren't as good as I had previously remembered them. Holy crap, is it kind of awful to watch a perfect kind of like excretion of 1990s culture plop on your television set. A very charming and awful movie. That is nonetheless charming because all the actors are pretty good. But gosh, is it it's fully anachronistic. You find yourself wishing that there was a Facebook back then, so you wouldn't have the absolute ridiculousness of the premise and much else besides.
But now, have you compared it to the original Parent Trap? Is that one hold up?
I want to go back and look at it, but my eyes are stained. Even more than Gary Gilmore's at this point. And so you know, in my precious time, I don't think I'm ever going to subject myself to that possible pain. But who knows?
I'll tell you right now, the frisson between Brian Keith and Maureen O'Hara in the original is scintillating. It burns through whatever screen you're watching. You could be watching
even
it on
more
a
than
4K
like the,
ultra mat.
Even and, more than the butler and the nanny.
Yes.
Subplot here in this one, which
the
was...
The 90s was an era, and actually, I guess every era is an era of awful remakes that sometimes are much better than the originals or merely show that the originals were not worth, not only not worth remaking, but not worth making in the first place, which is a darker thought.
Slade, what have you been consuming?
So I've started taking advantage of the massive open courses, online courses that are out there, and specifically through this website edX, which is like a clearinghouse for all of these different college, you know, universities. Like, it started with, I think, Harvard and MIT, but now it's open to a bunch of different colleges who can they put classes up on basically YouTube videos of their courses online, and anybody can watch them now. So if you want to take a class, a Harvard class or an MIT class or a Notre Dame class or whatever, you can just watch the lectures, and some of them even have the ability to like formally enroll and pay a fee and get a certificate at the end, like take tests and get a certificate at the end. I'm not doing that. I'm just watching the lectures as a sort of substitute for podcasts or TV, since I'm a true millennial and don't have access to really any live television in my life. This is substituting for it for me. So this weekend, I watched basically a Harvard music professor do a seminar on Handel's Messiah. That was one of the things I did this weekend, and it was excellent. And there are like 10,000 other options that you have from a bunch of different schools through these platforms. So I think they're pretty great, and it's not, I don't necessarily see it replacing university anytime soon, but I think it's a pretty cool thing that we have access to in the 21st century.
It's awesome. Suderman, I presume, have mostly been consuming Pierre Delecto's Twitter feed.
I mean, I found out who got that name before me. It was just amazing to see that Mitt Romney had actually picked the alias that I wanted. Definitely no one should follow Pierre Delecto too. I watched Parasite, the new movie by Bong Joon-ho this weekend. He is the Korean director who, if you've seen one of his films, he did Snowpiercer and then also did a film for Netflix with Tilda Swinton. And he's gone back to making films in Korean. And Parasite won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival this year. It's got 99% on Rotten Tomatoes, one of the very few films to have sort of opened and gone through the whole critical cycle and basically had a, you know, nearly universal positive recognition. It is better than reading Piketty in the original French. It is just a kind of masterpiece of social class satire. And if you've seen Snowpiercer, I don't know if anybody here has watched that, but it's great. I highly recommend it. And it's like this great metaphorical thing about like the world has ended. Only one train remains. It circles the globe. And the back of the train, like the further back in the train you get, the poorer people are. And it's about a revolt of the poor people as they move through the train through up until they get to basically God, who is played by Ed Harris in the main engine car. And it's just this fantastically sort of crafted action, like action, science fiction, dystopian thing that manages to dramatize wealth inequality. And it is a movie that manages to be an extremely political film while also being really good. And Parasite, without saying too much about it, it's a little funnier. It's not quite as much of a sort of overt genre, say horror or action film as some of his previous movies. But once again, it is a class satire about inequality. And I kind of, you know, he is totally to the to the left of me. He's not somebody who I would think I would sort of agree with his politics, but it's such an incredibly well-made film on an aesthetic level and on a kind of human level. It's really a humane movie in that it doesn't make out very wealthy people who exist in this film to be villains. Instead, it sort of seeks to kind of understand how all of these people interact in a system that it views as terrible. It's only playing in 6 cities right now, but it's going to be opening in a dozen or so more cities next Friday. I highly recommend it, just if you like interesting and well-made movies.
Nick, take us home. What have you been consuming, sir?
I have read and interviewed for a future podcast Megan Daum, who wrote a book called The Problem with Everything, My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. She is kind of peak Gen X, and it's a fascinating meditation on, you know, changing popular culture tastes, you know, from the 90s through the current moment. Its origin story is kind of interesting. She was originally going to write a book about changing definitions of feminism, starting in 2016 with the assumption that Hillary Clinton would be president. So the question before her was, what does feminism mean when we have a lady president? It didn't work out that way. And it's a wonderful series of essays about, you know, what has changed in American culture, lived culture, from kind of, you know, a Gen X perspective to millennials and Gen Z. It's what's really good about it is she is not libertarian. She's not certainly not a conservative, but also not a lefty. And it's in the best form or best tradition of essays. She's like working through her thoughts, which are very contradictory and all over the place. So The Problem with Everything, My Journey Through the New Culture Wars. Hopefully that'll get a lot of tongues wagging.
Very good. That's all the tongue wagging we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast.
That was a callback to all of the Kiss talk, of course, Matt.
I mean, like when you have to explain the art.
Well, yeah, I wanted to go on a whole sustained sub-thread about the Vinnie Vincent invasion, but I think we'll leave that for next week.
It was implied. But anyways, thanks for listening. Leave a comment, subscribe, tell your friends, go buy yourself a steak, and see you next week. Bye.